Hello, and welcome to Mirkwood Designs, Adventures in Creativity. I'm your host, Ruth Ann Logsdon-Zaroff, and this is podcast number one, my premier podcast. By the way, this series also has an accompanying website with show notes, links, patterns, and projects. Just head over to mirkwooddesigns.com. That's M-I-R-K-W-O-O-D designs.com. First, a little bit about me. I'm the youngest in a family of six children, each of whom is creative in his or her own way. I'm married to Ted, who would like to think he's creative, but unfortunately, I think he didn't get the creative gene. And we have a 19-year-old son, also named Ted, although we usually call him Teddy, and he is definitely creative. He got many more creative genes even than I did. Collectively, I refer to my husband and my son as the Teds. We have three cats. They were all raised by Teddy. He's the cat daddy around the house. And I know that you'll learn a lot more about the Teds and the cats and the rest of my extended family in upcoming podcasts. So we'll just stop there about that. The first time I ever began paper crafting was when I was about 5 years old and I was watching Captain Kangaroo. And he had little craft segments now and then. And this particular segment, he told us to get our supplies, which were a shoebox, a couple of pencils, and four spools of thread. And out of those wonderful supplies, we made a little car that actually rolled on the floor. And I also remember one June, he had us make flags for Flag Day. My mother was so impressed that television could be educational. And this was way back before Sesame Street. This was back in the 1950s. And since then, I have enjoyed paper crafting. I also, probably some of you know me from Mirkwood Designs, the paper crafting templates. I've been doing paper crafting templates for a long time. The templates have been available on the web for about 10 years. If you go to mirkwooddesigns.com, you'll find a link there to my paper crafting templates. They're free for you to download. I've been sewing most of my life, almost as long as I've been alive. My mom gave me a needle and thread and a button when I was about 3 years old, taught me to sew a button on, and I haven't stopped since then. I handcrafted Barbie clothes probably when I was about 5 years old. I started doing that. I designed them and handcrafted them. And then my mom taught me to use her sewing machine when I was about 7 or 8. I remember the first thing I made on that was a pink gingham apron, and I sure wish I still had it. I'd love to know whatever happened to my little gingham apron. One of the favorite sewing projects that I learned to do over the years was make Halloween costumes. That was probably my favorite holiday every year, and my costumes were the most creative things that I would see walking around. I never, ever bought a store-bought costume for myself or for my girlfriend, Donna. I remember one year, Donna and I decided we were going to go as Noah in the Ark. And I was Noah, and I just wore a big, long robe, and I carried a staff, and I had long hair and a big beard. Donna was the Ark. It was just a tour de force, her costume. She took a big box, and we glued little animals all over it, and she was the Ark. And the next year, we decided to go as Moses and the Red Sea. She wore the Noah costume from the prior year, and I walked around with a spray bottle and with water in it, and I was the Red Sea. Anyway, so over the years, I've made many costumes for Halloween, and when we had our son, I designed all of his Halloween costumes, and it gave me such pleasure to do that. He just had the most wonderful costumes over the year. He was a praying mantis one year. He was a knight one year. He was Peter Pan one year, complete with a Tinkerbell that lit up, that sat on his shoulder. I also designed Renaissance Festival costumes. I won first place one year in the Michigan Renaissance Festival for my costume design. And I've also done many, many school and community theater costume designs for productions. I just finished doing costumes for The Sound of Music, as a matter of fact. Over the years, I've also developed interests in other hobbies, like stained glass. I do lamp working, which is making glass beads. I have made jewelry most of my life also. Right now, I work a lot in Swarovski crystals. And I'm also a musician. I have sung. The very first time I remember singing, I was about 2 years old, and I sang along with the priest at church. And that's consequently where I've ended up singing most recently. I sing in my church choir, and I'm also a cantor, and I substitute for the music director there. I used to perform professionally, though, and I toured in Europe, and I toured in Japan. I worked over there for quite some time, and I played in clubs around the Detroit area. I play guitar, I play the banjo, I play auto harp, any number of folk instruments. I also studied piano for many, many years, It taught me to read music, but that's about it. I could plunk out a melody now, but I can't play a note otherwise. And I studied voice for a long, long time. I performed in Gilbert and Sullivan operettas for about a decade. And as I said, now I pretty much sing for the glory of God. So anyway, all of this brought me here, right now, to this podcast and my blog, and I'm hoping that all my little creative endeavors will come together to make one gigantic creative endeavor. You know, for some reason, when I was younger, I was trying to hurry through my life. My mom would tell me, oh, when you get older, everything goes so fast. Slow down, enjoy everything now. And I just wanted to do everything right here, right now. I wanted to accomplish everything right away. You can tell I talk fast, too. And, you know, I eventually learned in my older years that creativity is not a race. It's an adventure. It's a journey to be savored every step along the way. My podcast will be broken up into different segments. Every podcast, I'll have a fiber arts segment, a paper arts segment, and since we creative types need sustenance, I'll also provide an original recipe. And finally, the grab bag, which is topics that don't fit anywhere else. Well, at least that's my plan for now. Who knows? Maybe this great creative adventure may lead me down a different road. But for now, I'm going to follow the map I have before me. So according to my podcast roadmap, up next is the fiber arts segment. And today's topic is red work. Welcome back. I'm Ruth Ann Logsdon-Zaroff, and you're listening to Mirkwood Designs, Adventures in Creativity. Before I continue, I forgot to mention about the music I'm using for my podcast. As I mentioned in the earlier segment, I am a musician. I've sung and played a number of instruments my entire life. So I decided I would just provide the music myself. And all of the music I'll be using is either original or in the public domain, or in the case of an upcoming song, I have the permission from the composer. The song I'm using for the entrance and closing is a song called Simple Gifts, which is an old Shaker dance tune from the 1800s. And in it, I'm playing Appalachian dulcimer and guitar. And the song I'm using for bumper music, which is the music in between the various segments of my podcast, is a classical piece called Shall I Sue? By 17th century composer John Dowland. I hope you enjoy the music. Anyway, this is the fiber arts segment, and we're going to talk today about the needle art of red work. On the website, mirkwooddesigns.com, you will find the first in a series of free downloadable red work patterns that I designed just for this podcast. First, a little bit about the history of red work. It became popular in the late 1800s and reached its peak in the early 1900s. It's called red work because one of the first color-fast threads available was turkey red, a deep red found not only in thread but also in quilting fabric of the 19th century. Eventually, as other thread dyes became color-fast, women began to stitch in different colors as well. Women stamped or ironed line drawings onto a variety of items from tea towels to dresser scarves and so forth, and then they stitched on the lines, usually using simple embroidery technique called stem stitch. Unlike cross-stitch, red work is not necessarily worked on even weave fabric, because you stitch over a drawn or a stamped image, and you don't have to count threads. You know, in counted cross-stitch, we actually count threads. We use eight a cloth, and we have to count the threads. But because red work images are stamped on the fabric, it can be done in any kind of a linen or on muslin. And because of that fact, also, it's a wonderful way to get children interested in needlework, because they just have to learn a back stitch or a stem stitch, and they stitch along the line that's drawn on the fabric. As a matter of fact, that's a pretty good way to get your child interested. You could take a favorite coloring book of theirs and trace a picture from the coloring book onto a piece of muslin, and they can practice their stitching techniques using a picture that they really like from a coloring book. On my website, you'll find a couple of illustrations of the two different sewing techniques that I use when I do red work. I like to do both the back stitch and the stem stitch, and occasionally, of course, I'll use things like a French knot. But both the back stitch and the stem stitch are fairly easy. I have an illustration of both showing you. Now, I'm right-handed, so the illustration is for a right-handed person. If you're left-handed, or wrong-handed, as I say, you can just flip the illustration and use the numbers in reverse order. You can, when you go to the website, you'll see what I mean. And it's really easy to draft your own red work pattern. You can use a favorite picture, as I mentioned, a child's coloring book, or even a photograph. What you would do with a photograph, for example, is you would use a light box, or you could use a window or a glass table with a lamp underneath, and you would just tape your photo up to the window and a piece of fabric over it, and you would just trace the basic outline of the photo. You don't want to get terribly detailed. I have an example on the website. I have a photograph of my son's kitten, Titus. It's not a very good photograph. And then I did a line drawing based on the photograph, and I did a finished piece. And from the taking of the photograph all the way through the last stitch that I took in that piece of fabric was about 2 hours. So I ended up with this original piece of red work. I worked it in black thread, but it's not black work. I'll talk about black work on another podcast, what black work actually is. But at any rate, I created this a piece of original red work based on a photograph of my son's kitten. You can also work red work in other colors of thread. For example, my sister Karen, who is an accomplished artist, was inspired by our mom's love of Hummel figurines. Our mom spent years cross-stitching so many different Hummel pictures. She provided them for her children, her grandchildren. All of us have one of the beautiful Hummel cross-stitch pieces that she did. And after she died, my sister wanted to honor my mom's memory, and she made a quilt featuring I think it's 12 different Hummel children, and she drafted these from my mom's cross-stitch patterns. She made line drawings based on the pictures of the Hummel figurines, and instead of working them in red, she wanted it to work it in green. The quilt is going to be in her guest room, and so she wanted to work it in green instead, and she stitched it in green floss, and she drafted, as I mentioned, all of the patterns herself. Now, unfortunately, I can't make these patterns available to you because of copyright restrictions, but I do have photographs of two of her original green work blocks on my website. That's mirkwooddesigns.com. So you can take a look at that and see the kind of thing that you can draft yourself. Now, as a gift to all of my listeners, I have drafted, or I'm in the process of drafting, a set of 10 or 12 Alice in Wonderland red work patterns. I am a large fan of Alice in Wonderland, in particular, the original illustrations by Sir John Tenniel, that Lewis Carroll hired him to illustrate the original books. And I have drafted several of the pictures, and I intend to draft more, and I'm making them available to you. Each podcast, I will have another free download. This time it is Alice and the Pig Baby. There is a picture of my finished red work on the website, and there's also a link to the downloadable PDF file, and it is free, and I hope you enjoy it. So if you go to my blog, which is mirkwooddesigns.com, and in my podcast notes for the podcast, you'll find links to all of my projects. You'll be able to download the PDF file. And if you need Adobe Reader, there's also a link to Adobe Reader, because you will need that to open the PDF file. And I really hope that you enjoy my free red work patterns. Stay tuned for the paper art segment. Today's topic is paper crafting supplies, and I'll also share with you my method of making something we all need now and then, a basic envelope. Welcome back to Mirkwood Designs Adventures in Creativity. I'm Ruth Ann Logsdon Zaroff. In today's paper crafting segment, we're going to talk about paper crafting supplies, and I'll also tell you how to make a basic envelope. On the website, mirkwooddesigns.com, you'll find the basic envelope template. You know, I've been paper crafting for most of my life. I remember, aside from my Captain Kangaroo adventures, I remember we were supposed to have brought a number 10 or a business envelope to school one day. We were studying letter writing or something like that, and I completely forgot to bring my envelope from home for class. And so before class began, I actually took a piece of paper, figured out how to make the envelope in the right proportions, folded it together, glued it shut, and I used that for the class. And you know what? That must have pulled the wool over my teacher's eyes because I didn't get into trouble. And I went to the kind of school where, you know, I'd probably get my knuckles whacked by the nuns if I didn't get it right. I'm joking about that. Anyway, so I've been paper crafting. I've always enjoyed making cards and making little ornaments out of paper. I loved origami when I was little, and I taught my son, and my son has moved light years beyond me as far as origami goes. I can remember sometimes when I was at work, if I was in a meeting, sometimes I'd be in a teleconference, which meant that I wasn't in a meeting room. I would be at my own desk with a headset on listening to meetings. And I would sit and I would make things while I was listening in on the meeting. And I'm one of those people, I really like to multitask. As a matter of fact, I find that I concentrate and I retain information much better if I'm doing something with my hands. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I know my son is the same way. And my husband is exactly the opposite. He has to devote his full attention to one thing and one thing only, or he can't get anything accomplished. Anyway, so my son and I both like to have every screen in the house going. We have the computer, the phone, the TV, and we're also working on a project, or sometimes two. And my son usually has a cat in his lap when he's doing all of this. But at any rate, about 10 or 15 years ago, I started deciding that I should share my templates with people. And when the internet became so popular and so easy to develop for, I started designing templates and offering them free on my website. The templates are still out there. I still add to them periodically as I'm inspired, but it's mirkwooddesigns.com. There's a link on my website to my templates website. All the templates used to be at mirkwooddesigns.com, and I moved them over to ruthannzaroff.com, which is where they reside now, and I think I'll keep them there. But those templates are free for your download. I have some projects out there too. These are older projects. I won't talk about them probably in this podcast, but maybe I'll resurrect one or two to share with you. Probably the most basic thing that we need to have when we're going to do paper crafting, basic things, I should say. I have a little list and a picture on my website of things that you need, and I'll go through them right now. You really should have a good cutting surface, a self-healing cutting mat. They're often used. Quilters use them with their rotary cutters. You can get them from teeny tiny size up to big, huge, full table size. I have just about every size that's made out there. And I have them in just about every room in my house, because if I didn't, all of my surfaces in my house would be cut up either with my rotary cutters or with my X-Acto knife. I have definitely made a few scars in tables here and there. So a self-healing cutting mat, a pencil or two. I really prefer a mechanical pencil, and it should have a pretty good eraser. Adhesive tape, and if you can afford it, get some removable adhesive tape too. But if you want to have scotch tape or your regular adhesive tape and you want it to be able to remove it, tap it on your clothes, the sticky side on your clothes first, before you stick it to your paper. And it won't really stick on your paper that hard, but it will hold whatever you're trying to hold in place for a while. And then you can remove it. Some sort of a folding tool. I really like a bone folder. Because it doesn't make any kind of marks on the paper, but you can use a butter knife or any number of other flat things like that, pieces of wood. You need something that's going to be able to really make a nice crease in the paper that you're folding. Scissors, of course, and I'm going to tell you, don't use fabric scissors. Well, you can use fabric scissors to cut paper, but once you've cut a lot of paper, you won't want to go back to cutting fabric with those scissors. It really does dull them quickly. Permanent marker. That's probably not that essential, but I find I use it quite a bit. Some sort of paper glue. There's a wide variety of paper glues out there, so find one that you like. Right now I'm using Aileen's Tacky Glue. It just happened to be what I had around the house, and so it seems to work pretty well. Some sort of a craft knife. The brand I use is X-Acto, and I buy the blades by the bucketful. And make sure when you're working on a project that you have a very sharp blade. People sometimes feel that if you have a sharp blade, you're going to cut yourself. Actually, the truth of the matter is, and I find this true of kitchen knives as well, if you have a dull blade, you're more likely to cut yourself because you have to press harder. And sometimes you don't hold the knife or the blade properly because you're trying to cut with it. and the blade will slip. So your blades should be kept very sharp. As you dull your blades, toss them out. Wrap them up in a piece of tape and toss them in the trash that way. Don't just throw them in the trash because they could come back out and cut you, and that would be very unfortunate. It's happened to me. And of course, we can't forget a ruler. There is a wide variety of rulers out there. For paper crafting, don't use your quilting rulers. That's not what you need. What I like for my paper crafting, there's two different kinds. I like the see-through rulers that have the metal edge, but my ruler of preference for paper crafting is an 18-inch metal ruler, and on the back of that ruler, there's cork. And the cork makes it so that it doesn't slide around on your paper as you're making your project. Those are the absolute minimum tools that you need for paper crafting. There are so many other kinds of tools and implements out there that you can just fill up bins in your house. But as long as you have these things, you can pretty much make just about anything that I can recommend and patterns that I'll be giving to you on the podcast. If you look at my website, you'll see photographs of a couple of envelopes that I made using the simple envelope template. On the left is an envelope that I made. I actually printed the template onto the dull side of a piece of freezer paper that I had cut to fit my printer. And then I ironed it to a fancy paper. So the inside of the envelope is a fancy paper. It's really nice to have a lined envelope. It kind of makes it a little more elegant. And the paper I used was a little bit sturdy, so it made the envelope really a nice sturdy envelope. On the right is a piece of gold vellum that I ran through my printer, and I used decorative scissors on the flap of that envelope, as you can tell. In addition to the template, there are also some suggestions that you can use to kind of fancy up your envelopes a little bit more than the ordinary envelope. And I also provide instructions on how you can draft an envelope of any size. Now, I'm in the United States, and I know every country has different kind of postal regulations. If you're going to be sending your envelope through the mail, check your country's postal regulations before you go ahead and, for example, make a bunch of square Christmas cards and square envelopes. In the United States, for example, square envelopes actually have a postal surcharge. I think it's around 11 cents that in addition to regular postage. It has something to do with the way mail is metered. But I'm going to warn you, if you have any questions, say about whether your paper is sturdy enough or if it's too hard, too thick, or the size of your envelope, run by your post office, take them a sample, and ask what they recommend. You know, they're there to help you, and they are a wealth of information. So I hope you enjoy the template. And you know, I didn't mention this in the fiber crafting segment, but if you have pictures of things that you've made using my templates or my instructions, I would love it if you would send them to me and I will share them. I will make a gallery and share the pictures of your projects. So now you know where to go to find all my projects and my paper crafting templates and so forth. Just go to mirkwooddesigns.com and click on the projects link. Up next, how you can bring a little zing into your creative life with my sublime hot chocolate surprise recipe. Welcome back to Mirkwood Designs Adventures in Creativity. I'm Ruth Ann Logsdon-Zaroff, and this is the recipe segment. Each podcast, I'll give you a bit of culinary inspiration with my original recipes. You know, when I first got married, I did not know how to cook, and I honestly don't know how I kept my husband. The only meal I could actually successfully make from beginning to end was Thanksgiving dinner, and I know that sounds like, you know, if I could make Thanksgiving dinner and every single dish from scratch, surely I could put a meal on a table every day. Well, I have no idea what the deal was, but that was not true of me. I could not cook a meal every single day. Now, I did work out of the home at that particular time in my life, but that really wasn't the problem. I think the problem really was Thanksgiving I had down to an art, or maybe to a science. I had every single recipe codified, and I had it in a binder, and I did it exactly the same way because I asked my mother, who was the world's best cook, how she made her Thanksgiving dinner because I wanted to be my mom. That didn't work out so well, but the Thanksgiving dinner always turned out well. Anyway, over the years, I added to my recipe repertoire, but more often than not, I found us eating a lot of stuff out of packaged things like boxes and cans and frozen dinners. And you know, that's not really the healthiest way to eat. And over the years, I kind of gained a lot of weight too. And it all, you know, in all honesty, looking back on that period in my life, about 20 years or so, I think a lot of the reason I couldn't successfully lose weight and keep it off was because of all of those preservatives and chemicals and all of the, quote, convenience food that we ate instead of the healthy foods I should have been making all along. Anyway, when my husband was stationed in Cuba in 2000, I started watching the Food Network. I had never really watched it before then. But I found myself fascinated by one particular host, Alton Brown, and his TV show, Good Eats. He was like watching Bill Nye the Science Guy, only it was all about food. And all of a sudden, it all clicked for me. And thanks to Alton Brown, I learned how to cook. I understood that there's a reason that we do things the way that we do when we cook. So I became an avid fan, not only of Alton Brown, but I started watching more complex cooking shows. And I actually bought Julia Child's the Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and I began to master the art of cooking, period. So when my husband returned home from being gone in Cuba for a year, he returned home to a wife who actually knew how to cook. And I'm so proud to say that my son now actually believes that I'm the world's greatest cook. And I don't know. I imagine up in heaven, my mom looks down and she probably gets quite a laugh out of this because I really, truly was a pretty awful cook. My cooking was uneven. The food was usually not very good. But now I actually know what in the heck I'm doing. So much so that I have started to develop a lot of my own recipes. And also, I try to make everything from scratch. I no longer eat any convenience foods whatsoever. I don't buy frozen foods. I don't buy canned foods. I don't buy prepackaged foods. Everything we eat is made from scratch in my house. I make my own mayonnaise. I make my own peanut butter. I make my own bread. And I make my own mustard. And, you know, I'm going to share some of these recipes with you down the road. But the recipe I'm going to share today is something I'll bet you really, you won't only like it, but you'll be very surprised by it because there's a secret surprise ingredient in it. I'm going to share with you my recipe for hot chocolate surprise. Who doesn't like a nice cup of hot chocolate on a cold winter day? Well, the hot chocolate recipe I'm going to provide for you is hot in more ways than one. Not only is it temperature hot, but it's also spicy hot. You know, I remember seeing the movie Chocolat several years ago, and there was a secret ingredient in her hot chocolate, and the secret ingredient was red pepper. So my hot chocolate recipe has red pepper in it. Now remember, you can print out the recipe at mirkwooddesigns.com and you would click on the recipes link. And I'll go through it now though so I can talk about some of the ingredients with you. First of all, you're going to need 1.5 teaspoons of pure cocoa powder. Now I'm not talking about sweetened Nestle's cocoa. I'm talking about something along the lines of Hershey's cocoa powder, the kind you use for baking. It doesn't have any sugar or sweetener in it whatsoever. I happen to use Green and Black's organic cocoa. I got it at Whole Foods. That's just a personal preference. Hershey's works just fine. You'll need 1/8 teaspoon of cayenne pepper. That's the not-so-secret ingredient. Now, you can skip the cayenne pepper if you want, but if you do that, it's not hot chocolate surprise anymore. It's just plain old hot chocolate. You'll also need 1 tablespoon plus 1/4 cup of cold heavy whipping cream. I'm not talking about whipped cream that comes in a can or Cool Whip. I'm talking about the real thing, heavy whipping cream that you buy in your dairy section. You'll need about 1 tablespoon of semi-sweet chocolate chips. That's about 20 chips. You can use Nestle's chocolate chips. I really liked Calibo. That's a kind of a high-end chocolate. It's just one of those things. 3/4 cup of milk. I prefer whole milk, but you can use skim or 2%, whatever you prefer. 1 to 2 teaspoons of sugar. Now, I like demerara sugar, which sort of has a brown sugar flavor to it. It just adds another level of flavor to the hot chocolate. You can use brown sugar. You can use white granulated sugar, or you can use sugar substitute. Splenda works particularly well. And you'll also need grated chocolate. I really like Scharfenberger bittersweet, but it's up to you, whatever you choose to use. You could even just sprinkle cocoa powder on the top if you'd like. Now the tools you need are pretty basic. You'll need measuring spoons, your mug, a small whisk or a fork, access to a microwave oven, or you can use a small saucepan and a stovetop if you prefer, a small measuring cup, and if you would like to grate chocolate on the top, you'll need some sort of a fine grater. Okay, so in the bottom of your mug or in a small saucepan, if you're using a stovetop, you're going to whisk the cocoa powder, the cayenne pepper, and 1 tablespoon of the heavy whipping cream until the mixture is smooth. Then you'll add the chocolate chips and the milk, and you're going to stir those to combine and microwave on high for 1 minute. Remove the cup from the microwave, and you're going to stir. Then you're going to microwave it 1 minute more, and you're going to remove and stir again. You want to make sure that the milk is steaming and that the chocolate chips are all melted. Or if you're using a stovetop, you're going to do this in your small saucepan, but you need to make sure that your milk does not curdle and that your chocolate doesn't scorch. That can happen really fast on a stovetop. So you're going to heat it on a low heat, and you're going to heat until the milk is just simmering and the chips are all melted. And then you'll pour that into your mug. So now you have your hot chocolate in your mug, but it's not sweetened yet. So now is the time to add your sweetener of choice. Starting with 1 teaspoon of whatever your sweetener is, you're going to stir it into the milk mixture. I found that 2 teaspoons of the demerara sugar was perfect for me. You might like a little sweeter, or maybe you don't like it quite so sweet. When you have that all mixed together, you're going to pour the remaining heavy whipping cream into the measuring cup, not your mug yet. You're going to put it in the measuring cup, and you're going to whisk it really well with your fork or your whisk until it's slightly thickened. This can take a little bit, and it'll give your arm a workout. When it's thickened, you're going to carefully pour the whipped cream on top of your hot chocolate. And then, to top it all off, you can grate some chocolate on the top, or you can sprinkle some cocoa powder on the top. And there you have my hot chocolate surprise. I really hope you give it a try, because it's something special. So I'd like you to go to the recipe page, and you're going to find the free downloadable recipe. And don't forget, you'll need the application Adobe Reader to open those PDF files. The link to Adobe Reader is also on the projects page. Next up, we have the final section of my premiere podcast, The Grab Bag. I'm going to talk a little bit about my ideas of creativity, and I'm also going to thank those pioneering podcasting women who have gone before me, who have inspired me to become a podcaster. Stay tuned. To Merkwood Designs Adventures in Creativity. I'm Ruth Ann Logsdon-Zaroff, and this is The Grab Bag. Each podcast, I'll wrap things up with stuff that just doesn't fit anywhere else. Since it's a grab bag, it could be anything, a poem, a story, or even a song. Today, I'll leave you with this bit of creative inspiration from 20th century American psychologist Abraham Maslow. He said, "The key question isn't what fosters creativity, but it is why in God's name isn't everyone creative? Where was the human potential lost? How was it crippled? I think, therefore, a good question might be not, why do people create, but why do people not create or innovate? We have got to abandon that sense of amazement in the face of creativity, as if it were a miracle if anybody created anything." That's so true. You know, I'm always surprised when people are amazed at the small, tiny things that I create. It can be as simple as a card that I've made, an envelope, a little quilt, whatever. They're always so shocked and amazed that I could create this wondrous thing. And I think to myself, why aren't you creating? Why isn't this something that you can just go home and do yourself? It just surprises me that people somehow have no confidence in their own creative ability. And that is really a pity. I think that for some reason, when we're children, we're so full of creative potential. And I don't know if it happens maybe when we enter school and all of a sudden we're bound by rules and regulations, but somehow over the years, the creative spirit is beaten out of us. I have a little story I'll tell you before I end. I remember that when my son, Teddy, entered kindergarten, he was so full of excitement to be going to school with the big kids. And, you know, we knew he was a little bit bright. We thought, oh, you know, it's the way all parents do. Our child is just a nice, bright little boy. Before he started school, he could read and he knew his colors and his numbers and everything. And he started school at this particular private school. We were very happy to have gotten him in there. And after a couple of weeks, he started coming home really kind of sad and depressed. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And one day he told me, he says, "Mama, today was the color blue, and everything we did had to be blue. I wanted to color a tree, but I was only allowed to use a blue crayon." And I thought, how in the world could this child's creativity be stifled like that? I didn't understand the teaching methods. And as it turned out, the teacher ended up calling me in a couple months into the school year, and she said, "There's something wrong with your child. I think he might, maybe he's retarded or something. He doesn't seem to be able to fit in or follow directions. I think you should have him tested." So indeed, we spent the money and we sent our child to a pretty renowned child psychologist, and we had a battery of tests done. After the tests were all completed, we were called into her office and she sat us down and she said, "You know, the only thing that's wrong with your child is that he has a genius IQ." So there's an example of a child who had the creativity almost beaten out of him. We ended up pulling him out of that school. Actually, frankly, he was asked to leave the school because they said that they couldn't deal with a child with an intellect like that. And so we pulled him out. We had him tutored the rest of kindergarten, and he ended up going to a gifted and talented school for the rest of his elementary school years. And he ended up with a fabulous art teacher. He ended up being a very creative child, and he was allowed to color with any color of crayon that he wanted. Anyway, I'd like to thank you for listening to this, my very first podcast. I hope it's not my final podcast. And in closing, I'd like to give special recognition to those pioneering podcasting women who have gone before me, who have inspired me to jump into the podcast fray. They are, in first name alphabetical order, Alex Anderson of Quilt Connection, Allison Rosen of Within a Quarter Inch, Annie Smith of Quilting Stash, Bonnie McCaffrey of Bonnie's Creative Quilting Adventures, Bri Lynn of Sew Stitch Create, Diane Gilliland of Crafty Pod, Jackie Kunkel of Jackie's Quilting Chronicles, Jean of The Quilted Cupcake, Jennifer Ruvalcaba of Patchwork and Pacifiers, Kelly of The Pioneer Quilter, and even though she's no longer podcasting, Nadine Ruggles of Driven to Quilt. You can find links to these podcasts, show notes, projects, and much more on my website, mirkwooddesigns.com. That's mirkwooddesigns.com. While there, why not make a comment or drop me a line and tell me what's on your mind? You can email me at ruthann@mirkwooddesigns.com. Remember, Ruth Ann is one word, spelled R-U-T-H-A-N-N, @mirkwooddesigns.com. I hope to hear from you. Until next time, this is Ruth Ann Logsdon-Zeroff with Mirkwood Designs Adventures in Creativity. And remember, creativity isn't a race, it's an adventure.